Greetings, cows. This is Jay. Jay Nemro. You know me. This is the podcast. This is Quasi-Indefatigable Zenilith, and we've been talking about Godsend. This is Godsend. Who knows? I'm going to stop giving things part numbers because it's not important. I'm not doing a whole string of things. We're going to talk this time about the beginnings of the Convocation. Sabrina, who is a character in... It's really not a character in the story of Godsend. Honestly, I don't think this stuff really comes out. If it does well and there is another book to come out of it, I've always kind of envisioned a third book called The 4 Days and After Years that kind of talks about the early days of the people of Aled and their final falling apart because they're just so corrupt and evil and weak. And I think that's what happens when we become corrupt, is that we become weak. And somebody else can easily take over. I've always kind of pictured there being a third book if the original Godsend story strikes a chord and it does well. Then I would go on and do a third. I'd probably do it anyway, just because I've been spending so much of my free time doing this. I might as well just go on and do book number 3 later. A whole lot of the stuff is already developed anyway, just because it's kind of the background of the Book of Godsend. Anyway, let's talk about the Convocation. Sabrina is the enemy of the first queen. Her name is Seradio. She was the first king's wife. First king was called Trachean. He was seduced by Sabrina. She liked the power. She liked all the things that came with kind of being the mistress of the king. The king, over this time of being seduced by this woman, had estranged himself from his wife. And his wife had taken off, gone somewhere else. Built up an army, brought that army back, took over, destroyed them. Settled the problem of the evil that Trachean had started bringing the people into because of Sabrina. Well, after this is all done, Sabrina actually escaped. She is I don't know how you describe Sabrina. She is, I wouldn't say she's the ultimate feminist. She is the ultimate power woman. She wanted power. The reason why she seduced Trachean and used him, she used him like a puppet. He was her puppet. She wanted power. The easiest way to get power was to seduce the king who had power. He could tell people what they were going to do and they would do it. So after Trachean was destroyed, he was actually killed. This girl wanted power still. And she used everything she could to make it happen. She used her knowledge of people, and she had great knowledge of people. She was definitely evil. In a religious sense, she got that power from Satan. The devil, the evil one, was giving her this information on how you destroy people, how you work on their greed and their pride and their lust, and you can destroy people this way. And that's exactly what she did. She destroyed people for power and gain. That's a theme all throughout. We saw it in Mormon theology that is where evil has its basis in. It's in power and gain. How much power can you have? How much money can you get? That's not strictly speaking gain, but it's one of the predominant ways we have gain these days. So, she... of course, the king wasn't the only man that Sabrina had under her thumb. I mean, she was everything that you would expect a person that men would practically worship was. Beautiful, smart, she would take a man, she would suck him in, she would seduce him, and she would warp them to her purposes. They were like puppy dogs in her presence, and they would do whatever she said. Well, she knew that now rule involved women, so it wasn't much of a question of getting power over men. That was only one facet of what she had to do. She also had to co-opt that power that women had now. She had to suck in the women too. She used men to do it. She would have these men, and this comes from a culture that's much more like our own in the beginning. The Allied was much like we were. You know, men were basically the out front people. They were the ones that went out and worked. They were the ones that represented the family and headed the family and stuff like that. She would seduce those men and draw women into her cause. And I would imagine, not having really delved deep into this, I would imagine that she did it by, you know, by kind of trashing men. By saying, look at men, you know, who made them the rulers of everything? Who made them the head of the household? They always do things poorly. They always forget things. The only thing they're good at is fixing things on occasion when they can fix anything at all. Because women really run everything. We should be in charge. She would use that kind of mentality, I would imagine, to make these things happen. Well, it's very simple to take Sarah Dio's daughters, the families that they were in, the husbands they had married, and corrupt those men through the ways that she had, and draw them into very disgusting, perverted things. And, I just ran over a bird. I always hate it when I run over a bird, but you can't hardly stop it. They run out in front of your grill to pick off the bugs on your grill, and you're going 55. They can't match that. So you run them over. I'm sorry. Anyway, through very perverted means, that's why I've always been concerned about writing this book about how it actually happened. Because it's evil, and I don't really want to expose evil for what it was, except just to say that she used very sexual perverted means to draw in these daughters of Sarah Dio, the ones that would ultimately rule after she was gone. And it was somewhat secret then, because they needed to keep the secret from Sarah Dio. And that's what they did. They would have these trysts, almost. They'd bring these girls together, and they'd start trying out their control techniques on these men. And they'd have these almost little sadomasochistic things that she pulled these daughters of Sarah Dio into. So that, and let me tell you, you feel a little bit of power, I don't care who you are, it tends to really, you like it, you like the sense of power, you like the fact that there's five or six guys that will just be at your beck and call, and you can have anything you want, because you can just tell them, go out and get it for me, and they will. They'll go out and they'll work for you. They'll do whatever you want. You reward them with intimacy or with strokes, whatever you want to. You treat them basically like dogs. And they'll respond because they like that, especially if you withhold things that are almost natural for a man. Sex, food, a little bit of pride that they can have. And you can use that against each other. You can have all of your men kind of in a competition, because men thrive in competition. And you want them to thrive. You want these guys to feel that their life is complete while you're under some woman's thumb, while she's basically controlling you. And she'll play one man against another. There'll be contests to see who gets to be in her bed tonight or for the next week or the next year. who gets to be number one in her eyes because they get perks that nobody else does. And y'all couldn't find out that you've got this system that men, you know, even though men might go, rah, 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 you know, I wish I had a little more control. I wish I could run my own life. They don't mind because they get all these perks from being the top dog in this woman's little stable, this woman's little kennel that she runs of guys. So, and this is something that exists today in the world of domination, sexual domination. It's almost a game that people play. But it does subtle changes to people. These men really start almost worshiping this woman. And that's really what happens in this situation, in the culture that surrounds what becomes the convocation, which is the group, which is basically the group of all women. Now, it's important in any organization that it's kind of stratified, especially if there's a few people that want all the power. You really have to make a situation where everybody feels like they're getting something from it. It provides for their needs. And that's what this convocation is made to do. It's strictly for women. There are no male members of the convocation. Males are tools. Males are possessions. You can trade them around like trading cards. You can use them as bargaining chips. They're pawns in this game of women doing what they do. It's really interesting. I've been contemplating for a while how an organization like that can work with women, because women tend to be kind of catty. They tend to fight. They tend to have their spat. For the rest of this discussion, you really don't need to consider the man. You have to know that the men are practically slaves. And with just a little bit of work from women, they're perfectly content in their slavery. And so that you can never expect men to really care greatly about other things. Some men are. I mean, it's just going to be natural. You're going to have different people with different desires in life. But you can warp and steer those desires once you see them, so that they don't cause big problems in society. We do that ourselves. I think every society, to a degree, does that. You know, we tend to follow. It's just like the whole cow thing. The whole concept of you doing what other people want you to do rather than what you want to do yourself. The point to where you don't even know you have an independent will. I go out and I buy an iPod. Girls go out and buy a certain shade of lipstick. We wear certain kinds of clothes. And it's almost kind of weird. It's almost regimented. You go to a gang, for instance, which you think would be just a free-for-all, but it's not, very regimented. You know, what kind of clothes you can wear, what secrets you know, what kind of signs you pass, how you communicate with each other. It's very, very structured. That's because people require a bit of structure in their lives. Actually, they tend to thrive under quite a bit of structure. It's just the way we are. So this convocation does the same thing. It provides this kind of structure. There's a structure that's put there to keep men in their place and to keep men looking always toward women and toward what women want. And it's almost a mindset that you can't break out of. Men go, hey, women are in charge. Women are in charge. The world is satin and lace and frilly things, and making sure that the woman that I serve looks good to the other women. So men go out and they do all this work. They strive to give their women every everything that they want. As opposed to our culture that powerful women tend to be more manly, this one isn't like that at all. Women are very, very feminine in this culture. There's dresses, there's parties, there's get-togethers, there's balls, men to a degree are somewhat ornaments in this thing, you know, and to the point that in the convocation, everything kind of leads on to everything else, you know. You don't start out with some really interesting, crazy ideas, but they tend to build after a time, just for the simple reason that that's just the way it goes when you start doing this. Men are still idolized. The best men, of course, women get to decide who the best men are the most, well, there's actually two in this culture, especially at the time where the actual Book of God's Men begins. There's actually two kinds of men, and it just depends on what kind of woman you are. You get to pick. You know, women aren't so... There's a wide range of what women can find interesting, and men who want to succeed and want to be happy and want to feel like they have a little bit of control in their lives, they do whatever they can to make a woman happy. There are two kinds of men that are valued. One is the strong, handsome, beautiful type men. I don't know what you could say. Tom Selleck and people like that. Well, they have lots of muscles that can do a lot of work, but that also are beautiful. That any woman would be proud having this man escort her to a formal ball, where she goes and she shows off how beautiful her dress is, where she goes with those women who are her friends, usually her underlings, and where they, you know, will go, oh, well, she's just wearing that bag, and that's very much the kind of women that a lot of these women tend to be. There's also another thing. In this culture, of course, having daughters is the most prized thing. Raising up a daughter to work well within the society of the convocation is probably the highest honor that can come to a woman. A mother is to be the mother of a girl who succeeds in the convocation. That's the greatest honor that can come, or at least that's purported to be the greatest honor. So these women, one of the big things is to have daughters. It has become a known fact, although it's not actually biologically true, it's become a known fact that any important woman, there's actually one big striation. There's all the women who belong to the convocation kind of as just members. And then there's the leadership, those who are called ladies. And it's a title. It is a rank. It is the basic rank, is that you're a lady. And the whole thing about being a lady is, ladies only have daughters. They do not have sons. They do not give birth to boys. That's considered the great defining separation between who's a lady and who is a woman. Now, the problem is that biologically, this is pretty random. And if you have children at all, at least half of them are going to be boys. And any given woman is going to have both. Men is going to have both boys and girls born to her. Well, let me tell you, these things are controlled. Trust me. One of the whole points of the convocation is those who are in power, and it's just true in our culture too, it's just not women. those who are in power want to keep power. And the important part, especially when you're dealing with, say, like a monarchy, for instance, where there are certain families that are ordained to lead, to rule, to do that, it's kind of a hereditary thing. It's important that there is a way to show other people that God has ordained that this is so, that people don't question it readily when it's obvious that there's a difference. You can say, well, she's a lady. Let me show you why. She has no sons. She doesn't give birth to sons. That's the definition of a lady. The way they do it is they just don't let it be known that ladies have sons. In fact, the ladies themselves, to keep this thing going, it's kind of a secret. The higher you go in the convocation, the more secrets you know, because secrets are power in this thing. To have true knowledge is power in any society, I think. And it's important to know that even in this society, there's ways that this is done, so that only certain families produce ladies, and ladies have to have all daughters because they're somehow pure. They're somehow better than the run-of-the-mill woman, the run-of-the-mill member of the convocation. That's why they're the leaders. It's a biological thing. It's an ordained thing by some deity. Well, time's nearly up again. We're going to have to come back to this. So next time, we'll talk about how the book actually starts, because it has a lot to do with how a lady is determined. This is quasi-indefatigable Zenilith. We're grateful. I'm grateful that you're listening. I don't know who we are. It's me. I'm Jay Nemro. Don't be a cow. Don't just be a simple follower. That's the one thing, great thing that God Send the book is about, is not being a follower of the prevailing culture, because usually that will deter you from doing what's right, from doing what God wants you to do, from becoming like God, as God wants you to. And I'll leave this with you. Enjoy, don't be a cow.